The date is January 29th, 2020. So we interrupt 300 straight hours of Super Bowl pregame analysis to bring you this very special episode of The Other Side, the official podcast of the finest comedy club in all the land, the DC Improv. I'm your host, Chris White. We are about 1 month away from the return of a DC Improv favorite. Steve Byrne is coming in for 5 shows, February 20th through the 22nd. Steve, despite being a Pittsburgh Penguins fan, has been entertaining DC crowds with his stand-up for a long time. A few years back, he found some success on the small screen. Lots of people finally remember the TBS sitcom Sullivan and Son, which was Steve's creation, and he was also the lead. And since then, Steve has been expanding to produce content for the big screen. Steve directed Always Amazing, a documentary about the comedic magician, The Amazing Jonathan, one of my personal favorites. You can actually watch it on YouTube thanks to a partnership Steve made with All Things Comedy. Also, we're planning a special screening of that documentary on the Saturday afternoon when Steve comes to town, February 22nd, followed by a Q&A with Steve. Steve has also written and directed a movie called The Opening Act, which stars tons of stand-up comedians, and in the lead role, Jimmy O. Yang, who you may know as Jin Yang from Silicon Valley. Steve has also promised that more film projects are on the way. But you don't need me to tell you all this stuff. Well, we could just talk to the man himself. Joining us now on the phone, one of my favorites, Steve Byrne. Steve, how you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
How is 2020 treating you so far?
Good. Yeah, it's always nice to have that recalibration of thinking it's a new year, but you realize you're back at Arby's within a few days. So, yeah, it's good. Nothing's changed.
So you're saying you're firing all your resolutions, you're firing all cylinders as we're going?
Fuck it, yeah. Yeah. They never work. Yeah.
We love following you on Instagram because it's always fun to follow your travels. I think you're one of the best comedian follows because you're constantly posting everywhere you're going on the road. A lot of people just do shots from the club or anything like that. You're basically lying on the floor in countless wonderful travel destinations, and it really inspires me to go out and see the world.
Well, I think it's part of like why being a stand-up is so great is that you go to these markets, and I'll never forget I was in Honolulu, and we were doing shows back-to-back. Doug Benson was doing a show at the Pipeline Cafe like Thursday, and I was doing it Friday, so we were back-to-back. And I went to see a show Thursday, and then I said, hey, why don't we hang out tomorrow? You know, we're in the same hotel or whatever. And I called him, and he stayed in his room the whole day. And I'm like, dude, we're in fucking Hawaii. We're in Hawaii. And he still just wanted to just toke up and get high. So I think some comics just like the fact you can just nap and sleep in and be lazy and watch, you know, House Hunters International or whatever. But I do like to see the markets, and I do like to see the city and stuff.
Back up for 1 second. Doug Benson smokes pot? What?
Yeah, I don't know if you've heard about that.
Okay.
But he's not a health nut. He's really into weed, yeah.
I thought he was just a Christian comic. Oh, man, I guess I was misinformed. Oh, well.
Yeah, vastly. He's one of the best at it, though,
yes.
For sure.
It's a great show. I enjoy it. Well,
yeah.
I want to obviously ask you about your stand-up, but if you don't mind, I also want to talk about one of your other pursuits, which is directing. This is something that you've been really leaning into pretty heavily the last few years, and I'm kind of curious. You know, we see a lot of comedians obviously try to write movies. We see a lot of comedians trying to act in movies. I can't think of an insane number who have really kind of gone into directing, and you sort of jumped right into that. What made you kind of want to attempt this particular endeavor at this point in your career?
Well, I think like directing, ultimately, it's you're facilitating the story, right? And so when I did a documentary on The Amazing Jonathan called Always Amazing. It's on YouTube, and you know you see it for free. And basically, when I just a little backstory. Amazing Jonathan, great Vegas headliner, great comic magician, was diagnosed with cardiomyopathy and was told, you have an expiration date. You're going to die, so get your affairs in order. And he basically did, and he quit performing. And then he outlived expectations and said, I'm going to make a return to the stage. So basically, when I heard that, I said, well, God, I know Jonathan.
Yeah.
I know his story so well. I know so much about him. Somebody should do a documentary about his return to stage. And I was just so passionate about the narrative of the story that I called him up and asked if I could do it. He said, absolutely. And while I was doing that, I had been writing on the road a feature film about my early years in stand-up called The Opening Act, and basically, you know, hanging out with Vince Vaughn and Peter Billingsley and getting to meet Jon Favreau, I've known that, you know, you write about what you know.
Yeah.
So basically, I was on the road. Nothing was working out. I had a sitcom on for years, and my phone just went silent for quite a few years. It was either I had T-Mobile Boost or just there was nobody calling, and I figured nobody's calling. So I wrote this script as an exercise to just see if I could write a feature film. And I wrote about everything I knew. I wrote about, you know, what my perceptions and thoughts of stand-up were. I always thought it'd be fun to explore the world of stand-up via a kid's very first time on the road.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I did, of like understanding the echelon, the totem poles of an MC, a feature, and a headliner, knowing your place over the weekend, and seeing it through a fish out of water kind of eyes with the MC going on the road for the very first time. So I put all my experiences I had in 23 years into 4 days in this feature film. And, you know, basically when both of these things kind of came to fruition and were happening, you know, especially with the feature film, Vince said, "Hey, do you want to be in it?" Once we found out it was going, I said, "Well, you know, I'm too old to be the MC in feature, and I'm too young to be an established headliner." Like, visually, aesthetically, you want to look at somebody who looks like a headliner, maybe in his 50s or 60s or whatever. And
beat to hell, right?
Yeah. And so I just said, you know what? I'm just glad it's being done, so I don't think there's room for me. I could do a cameo or something. He said, "Why don't you direct it?" And I said, "Yeah, maybe I'll direct it." And then I didn't realize the responsibility that comes with it. But but ultimately, what drew me to directing, sorry, there's a long, drawn-out answer.
No,
what drew me to it was the fact that you get to facilitate the story, you're in charge of the story, and to me, making sure the story was facilitated the way I wanted it was more important than me being on the poster. You know, my name will be on the poster at the bottom saying directed by, written by, but I thought if I were to put things on the scale, what would I feel is most important? For me, what's most important is making sure that the story is done correctly, because I know the landscape and the optics of stand-up so well. So for me, that's kind of what drew me in. And now, because I've done those things, now I'm working on another feature film and then writing and directing potentially a TV project that I'm going to be working on. So it's something I never in a million years thought I'd ever be doing, ever. But, you know, here I am.
You know, you mentioned just the notion of, hey, when you said, yes, I'll be the director, you didn't have a concept of exactly what that meant. Like, whenever I hear someone when someone says, I'm a producer, like, I have no idea what that means. I think most people have no idea what that means. How much did you kind of have to learn on the job, and what was the hardest thing for you to learn as a director? Let's say for the opening act, because I would think it's different from documentary to feature film. I would think there's some differences, but, you know.
For sure. There's enormous differences between doing a documentary and a feature film. Doing a documentary, you know, you're telling a story, but you're not necessarily on set like everybody thinks. You set up the lights, you set up the cameras, you go over the lines with everybody. There's no script, you know.
Yeah.
For me, there's an outline of the narrative beats of the film, so I knew that, and I knew, you know, you have to let, especially with a lot of documentaries, archival footage tell the story. So I had to go to Detroit and go through all the pictures, all the videos. For example, one of the important parts of Jonathan's film is that he meets a kid that's going to end up being his road manager in Australia, and what brought them together was a Vicks VapoRub commercial, because the kid's father was in advertising and knew the kid loved Jonathan so much that they offered him this Vicks VapoRub commercial. So, like, for example, I got to go to Vegas, and I got to watch probably 80 VHS tapes until I hopefully, quote-unquote, you know, fingers crossed, find this holy grail. And once you find it, it's like, oh, thank God. So there's a lot of sweat equity that goes into a documentary. The feature film, because I wrote it and directed it, I'm responsible for everything story-wise. So I watched master classes with Ron Howard and Scorsese and Werner Herzog, and I read all these books that I could on directing, and I talked to some of my friends that had directed, but I'll tell you, like, literally nothing could prepare you for the onslaught of responsibility that you have for 12 to 14 hours a day, from pre-production to production to post-production. That's writing the script, that's filming it, and then that's editing. And all three are such separate entities that it's overwhelming, but at the same time, you know, especially when you're making a film, you got to remind yourself, and I did constantly, is that everybody that ever moved to Los Angeles with a suitcase and just a bunch of dreams in your head, it's like, well, it's happening now, you know, so don't fuck this up. Do not fuck this up. Go for it. Give everything you got to it. So it was enormous responsibility, but it was also an incredible blessing. I was very fortunate to have the opportunity to do it.
Yeah. You know, since film's a very visual medium, I know when you are, if people have watched your stand-up, they know that you have a degree of physicality to what you're doing. You have lots of act-outs. You move around the stage, and you're not just standing there talking to a microphone. So you're someone who has to think about how to deliver material. Visually, for a movie, there's got to be a million more details to pull in. I mean, what was it when you're the things you're trying to convey when you're thinking about how to set up a shot, how, you know, if you're following this guy onto the stage, how much of that did you kind of have to figure out on the fly? Because I got to think it's very different from just having, you know, hey, this is the script on the page. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you're not only part of a team, but you're leading the team. You're leading the charge. And so I may be taking these people into the Brea Improv was where we filmed the film. Mm-hmm. So I may be taking these folks to the Brea Improv, and I may know the nooks and crannies of the comedy club, but I don't know jack shit about making a film, okay? I've watched film like everybody else, and you have your opinions, but the good thing is when you have a great team around you. I had great producers in Vince Vaughn and Peter Billingsley. I mean, they've been involved in film, you know, Peter since he was 4 or 5, yeah. And Vince since his 20s, and then, you know, we had an incredible director of photography named Eric Edwards, who did a lot of Gus Van Sant's early films, and like he did Judd Apatow's Knocked Up, and he did Couples Retreat with Vincent Peter. So he's done a ton of like incredibly visually dynamic films. So getting to work with him and partner up with him and describe, you know, what it's like to be in a comedy club, what if visually and aesthetically it should look like, and trying to make the improv our Yankee Stadium, taking an MC who's doing open mics, going to Yankee Stadium. So that was always kind of like the mandate of we're leaving Kansas, we're going to Oz, and to make it visually look like a professional club. So I think in terms of the visuals, it was just making sure you get the coverage, and that's something you take for granted watching a film is reaction shots and all these subtle little nuanced beats that are in there that are communicating to you how you should be feeling about that moment. For example, a lesson I learned is that Vince, for example, in his movies will tell a joke, and if you just stayed on Vince, it's like, okay, well, that's funny. But what really gets a laugh is watching someone react to Vince, watching someone react to the joke. And so making sure we got the right reactions was very key, and a big part of this is getting the audience reaction shots. So there's so much visual that goes into, obviously, a film, but especially a performance-type film as well with stand-up comedy. It was overwhelming, but I think we got it.
Yeah. You know, there obviously have been other movies made by comedians about stand-up comedy or the process of going through the business. And the way you described, you know, the genesis of the story, this is kind of a personal one for you. What did you have a goal of like, this is the most important thing for me to convey, or this is the feeling, or this is the, you know, is there a lesson to this film, or is it just a very well-told story that people can do what they want with it?
Well, look, I'll tell you this. I've seen probably all the stand-up films you've seen. I've seen all the stand-up films everybody is familiar with or knows or that doesn't even know. You know, I tried to watch all of them before, like I wrote the film, and then once I found out we're going, I thought, shit, this is really happening. I didn't, you know, it was an exercise. And then I went back and watched a lot of different films on stand-up, from, you know, films that people maybe haven't heard of and then films that everybody knows. And my goal was to literally just make the best stand-up film about stand-up comedy, because a lot of those films, stand-up is the B story. You know, it's a guy that's got to fall in love, or, you know, his girlfriend's sick and the big sick, or, you know, I have the sleep condition with Sleepwalk With Me.
Yep.
And they're all fun, dynamic films, but I never felt that those really specifically honed in just on stand-up comedy. And this film is literally just about a kid's absolute gumption, wherewithal, and devotion and loyalty to the craft of stand-up comedy. And so that was my mandate, to just make it about that, nothing else. And yes, you need your B story. You need to set up that there's some dynamic and there's some hurdles he's got to overcome. So The first act is the first act, but once you hit the road in this film, I think it is the most genuine, authentic, fun, serious, all the elements of what stand-up comedy is takes place absolutely in that second and third act, for sure. And it's not negating the first act, but first act, it, you know, when you like a good joke, nobody likes, I love the way you say, knock, knock, who's there? It's like, you know, those are essential elements to a joke and essential elements to a film, but I think once you hit the road in this film, it's like a rocket. It takes off.
I mean, I find that fascinating, and I that really makes me excited to see this because, you know, as you mentioned, there's like a lot of stand-up comedy movies. It seems like some of them kind of get it right, but again, it's like you said, it's in the background or in the periphery, or something like Punchline, which is notorious for like one of the most wildly inaccurate depictions of a comedy club ever. You know, so to actually kind of just have it be about the kind of the craft of it all.
Yeah, I mean, in Punchline, you know. It's amazing that we still reference that film, and that was made, you know, almost, what, 35 years ago. And it's still one of the top-tier kind of films that are just about stand-up. And there's lockers in it, and there's, you know, there's so much things that I understand narratively why they did it, but it's not real. And so this one is fucking real. And not only do we not have lockers in it, we have so much inside baseball that the casual viewer will watch it because they're learning about what it's like to be on the road via this MC. But as the film goes on, there's so much like inside baseball that comics are going to get it, managers are going to get it, like the managers on the road and the managers of the clubs, they'll completely understand it. And some of it's going to float over the audience's head, but all those things need to be in there because it loans itself to the authenticity of what it's like to be in that comedy club for 4 days.
Well, I'm going to give you the chance to name drop. I mentioned in the intro that Jimmy O. Yang is obviously the lead character in this film, but I mean, I know you got like a murderer's row of stand-ups to appear in this film, and I'm curious, like, A, who they are, and then B, with that kind of vision in mind, were they amped to be involved in a project that was like this, that was actually kind of taking their craft and showing it in sort of a very realistic light?
Sure, yeah. Well, it's funny getting to talk about this because this is the first, I think this is the first interview I've done officially just about the film, so this is fun for me. So yeah, I'm not tired of it. I'm not exhausted by it yet.
That's another
so
question.
So Jimmy O. Yang plays the MC. Alex Moffat from Saturday Night Live plays the feature act, and Cedric the Entertainer plays the headliner. And then Whitney Cummings, Eliza Schlesinger, Angela Johnson, Kathleen Madigan, Bill Burr, Ken Jeung, Tom Segura, Russell Peters, Neil Brennan, Roy Wood Jr., Felipe Esparza, Brooks Wheelan. I know that there's some, Alonzo Bowden. There's just a ton of great comics in this film. And the good thing about the film is that we filmed it in Los Angeles, so I didn't have to fly anybody out. Nobody had to leave their house. And usually for most of the comics, other than our three principal actors, it was pretty much like a day or two for them to shoot their scenes. So even, I think, Neil Brennan, who plays the club manager, I think he had 4 days on set. Cedric we only had, I think, for 2 or 3 days, and he's such a major part of the film. And you would think, when you watch it, you think, oh, God, this guy must have been there the whole time. He was there for 3 days, I think. And he was so unbelievably great. But the good thing is that everybody that signed up knew their role. Russell Peters, Eliza Schlesinger, Brooks Wheelan, they knew the radio station. They've done radio, so they know what the comic's going through. So it was. I didn't have to explain much to anybody, which was really fortunate. You know, for me, it was so fun to get to work with these guys. And I think the thing that's going to surprise a lot of people when they see the film is that not a lot of improv. I think 90% of the film is done as scripted.
Thank God.
So there were lines that were pretty much improv, but for the most part, everything was done as scripted, especially Jimmy's kind of last set on Sunday night. He, you know, I don't want to give too much away, but all the material in it, for example, is written specifically just for that evening. And so when I was writing it, it was like, please, God, I hope this translates, because you can watch stand-up comedy at home, watch an hour special, and you might not even laugh out loud, but you think to yourself, oh, that's pretty funny.
Yeah.
But that Sunday set, it couldn't be that way. You had to laugh at it out loud.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
When we did all these test screenings, the Sunday night definitely resonated and was executed really, really well by Jimmy, but also I think the writing had to be really top-notch. It had to translate, and that's one of the things I'm most proud of in the film.
That's actually great, too, because that is another big bugaboo about, like, stand-up on TV or stand-up in the movies is when, you know, it's a set that's a written set, and then you're just watching it at home, and you're like, this isn't very good, and the whole premise is that this person is doing well. But fortunately...
I think this film, you know... If you want to watch stand-up, it's like, well, there's a 1,000-hour specials you can watch, right? So that was something I thought about and we discussed is, like, just give them enough stand-up to get by.
Yeah.
But really what makes this – everybody's been to a comic club. Not everybody's been on the road. And I think that's what I wanted to convey more to, than anything to people is – look, if you want to watch stand-up, go ahead and watch it, you know. But if you're going to watch this film, you're going to see what it's like to be on the road. And that, to me, was more important than, like, having jokes that were fucking killer or executed really well. It's not negating anything. It's not saying that there isn't good stand-up. There's some good stand-up in it, but that Last Sunday set is I think, what people are going to be wanting for.
Yeah. You know, a lot of these projects, you mentioned there's different phases of movie production, and then the editing is, of course, an entirely different skill set. I know a lot of people I've talked to about various projects they've worked on have said that, you know, when they get to the editing phase, they find stuff that they didn't expect to find, that maybe whatever their original vision was, it was maybe improved or altered in some way by, you know, the editing process. I'm curious, as someone who directed it and edited it, did you kind of find stuff that you weren't initially expecting to find as you were kind of piecing together the final version of this film?
Sure. I mean, the one thing I would say going into this film, it was written certainly one way and executed another way. So there's a lot of scenes that are hatchet jobs. The scenes turned into something I didn't necessarily think that they would have been when I wrote them. So they changed drastically due to the narrative of the story, because that's paramount. And there were scenes that were certainly manipulated to be something completely different. But the dialogue is there, which is good. So it's amazing how, look, you could. It's basically like, look, a script is like a grocery list, I think. This is my analogy after having gone through this. A script is your grocery list, right? So you go out, you buy exactly the groceries you want, and then basically you kind of cook it, and you hope to God that it's good, you know? And so from that grocery list, though, you know, you think you're making pasta, but you could end up with, you know, lo mein. So you just don't know what you're going to end up with because there's certain dynamics that once you're in the edit, you're surprised by in terms of maybe, you know, and this is not knocking anybody. This is just an example. I'm not saying specifically to our film, but it could be a performance. It could be a technical issue. It could be a thousand different things.
Yeah, right. The lighting is bad.
You got to circumvent, navigate certain elements that maybe are out of your control. There's so much. Look, there's 1,000 different variations of the opening act that could have happened based on the film. You could have taken it a really broad way. You could have taken it a very serious way. You could play with the tone of the film, for example. So there's so many different variations of scenes and films overall that I could cut 8 different versions of this film right now, for sure. And the one we ended up with is the one via test audiences, the one that we're most confident in.
So where are we at now? Where are we going to be able to see this?
Well, we just had our buyer screening, so we'll find out our fate probably within the next 2 months, I'd say, because it just takes a while for all the platforms and everybody to get back to you. And once we find that out, we'll know our home and our fate, and it'll definitely be released at some point, you know, probably in the back half of 2020. So I'm just really looking forward for everybody to seeing this thing and really... You know, there have been a handful of comics that we've shown it to, and one or two club managers and owners, and all of them just say the same thing. It's real. It's authentic. Tony Baldino out of Chicago, he owns like 10 of the improvs.
Yeah.
He said, you really nailed the world. And that, to me, was one of those moments where I said, okay, I think we did it.
That's great.
So we'll see.
That's great. I do want to ask this, too. Just as a stand-up, one of the things I think that appeals to artists about stand-up comedy is the immediacy of it, that you have an idea that morning. If you, with a little bit of writing and a little bit of preparation, you can test the evening, you can test the idea that evening and kind of, and put that thing on the road to production. You know, always amazing. You've worked on for several years, and then there's the press, and then there's the distribution, and you're going through the same thing with the other movie. As a stand-up comedian, as someone who can have that instant gratification of stand-up, does it drive you a little bit crazy to be involved in the movie process where it's like you're talking about something you worked on 2 years ago?
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely, it's just a different set of barometer. It's a different barometer of success or appreciation. Like when we put up the documentary on YouTube, for example, it was like, well, let's leave the comment section up. Let's live and die by the sword. You know, if it's good, it's good. If it sucks, it sucks. But at least, you know, we'll know. And I'm not, I don't want to sugarcoat it. I don't want to pretend it doesn't suck if it doesn't suck, or it does suck if it does suck. So we left the comment section up, and literally you could go to YouTube and see it's like 19,000 likes, 200 dislikes. And you read the comments, and I'd say like 99% of them are very positive. And you know, YouTube's a dumpster fire. So for me, that was like one of the most gratifying, satisfying moments of like, the public has spoken, they're telling us that they appreciate the film, and that to me meant more than anything. So, you know, yeah, it doesn't come in the form of a standing ovation or an applause break or whatever. It's just a different form of appreciation. But knowing that I went out with a buddy of mine with some cameras that we rented and edited this thing in my garage, and then, you know, 2 years later, something's got 19,000 likes and 200 dislikes. It's like, I'll take those stats any day of the week. That was really cool for somebody who had never done a documentary ever in his life. It's like, I'm pretty proud of that.
Not bad for your first time out. Well done. Yeah. Hey, you hinted that there's another project on the way. Is this still going to be in the comedy, stand-up comedy wheelhouse, or is this going to be something that takes you a little outside of that?
Yeah, I think, like, you know, the opening act, the tone of the film, for example, is something I wrestled with. So it's not strictly just a stand-up comedy film. It's not like a Sandler film or anything like that. It's more in the vein of, like, you know, it's more in the vein of, like, Swingers or Maid, where, you know, there's some serious elements to it. But it is overall a comedy. I think that that's kind of the tone of where I feel comfortable with. It's not Paul Blart Mall Cop. It's definitely more in the tone of like being
Paul Blart
realistic
too.
And yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's the second one. Yeah, it's wackier. I think that's the tone that this next project will be in. This next project is extremely personal, with some elements that are hopefully relatable to people. But and then there's a TV project I'm working on that's going to be essentially based off of the Jonathan and Joel's dynamic and Always Amazing. So we'll see what happens with that.
Awesome. Well, I definitely want to ask you about stand-up before I let you go. Every time we see you, it seems like you're running a new hour. And I know a lot of times you have kind of themes or concepts that sort of hold together each hour that you do. What are we working on now? What are we going to be hearing about in February?
Yeah, well, now that the film's completed, I basically kind of was off the grid in terms of creating another hour, because I've been working on this feature film for the last 3 years, which is probably a good thing, to be honest with you, because it really made me, you know, get really serious about making sure that this next one is better than anything I've done before. Because I think all the hour specials I've done have been good. They've been good, but they haven't resonated. They've been good enough to keep me sustained in the comedy clubs and ask back. But I was like, I'm doing something wrong. So I kind of recalibrated how I do things. And I thought, I've got to create a different, even aesthetic for this next hour. So the next hour I'm working on is basically a talk show, but I'm the only one on the talk show. So I'll come out and I'll do monologue, which is, you know, monologue, one-liners, kind of quick jokes. Then I'll do panel, which is more kind of storytelling or more cerebral or thoughtful kind of stuff. And then I'll do pure stand-up comedy. So it's 20, 40, 60 minutes broken up in three different brackets. You know, Neil Brennan had three mics, but that was a different thing where he could ping pong back and forth. This is strictly just a different take on writing styles and doing it through the conduit or the visual medium of a talk show. So it'll look like a talk show, but essentially you're just hearing stand-up comedy materials throughout the course of it. So I've been working with a good friend of mine named Argus Hamilton, who's a great, great joke writer here in Los Angeles, to help me with the monologue jokes. And then the other stuff is all just kind of on me. So I'm really excited about this one. I'll film it probably in the back half of 2020 once I get this film stuff done, you know.
So conceptually, the audience is in on the premise here. This isn't just something where you're just not, this isn't just a general structure for you in your head to have the set. People will know, hey, this is a talk show on stage.
Yeah, I think they'll absolutely be in on it. They'll be along for the ride. I think visually, once they see the set, they'll go, oh, I get this. This is kind of cool. And I think that's what will happen, too, when people see it, you know, on their TV or their cell phone or whatever. It's just, it'll look different. It's the same thing, but different, you know, and I think that's what always resonates with people is that some of the great movies, you could say, oh, well, Star Wars is just Greek mythology. It's the same thing, but different. I think that so many of the stand-up comedy specials have come out, and they all visually, aesthetically look the same. I thought, you just got to do something different. So hopefully I'm right. We'll see.
Outside the box. I like it. And for the monologue stuff, obviously the monologues are known for topical humor. Is this something where you're flipping that first 20 minutes again and again and again, or are you trying to find some stuff that's evergreen but still kind of has that monologue ethic?
Exactly, yeah. I think the majority of it is evergreen, but when I'm on the road especially, that's when I get to kind of spread your wings and do things that are more topical, knowing it's not going to make the final cut when you actually film the special. So I'd say 80% of it is evergreen when you go to the live show, but probably 15% of it is really topical. And some of those are, there's so many good ones. They're so fucking fun. But, you know, there's one I had about the, it sucks when you write a great topical joke and you know it's got the shelf life of milk. You know, there was one where Iran put out an $80 million bounty on Donald Trump's head. And my joke was, you know, they put out an $80 million bounty on Donald Trump's head. Poor Stormy Daniels. She had it in her mouth. She went and got $150,000. And it was like, I was so happy with that joke, and I was so proud of it. And I was like, fuck, you can only do it for 2 weeks.
Yep.
It sucks.
That's the one thing people keep saying about Trump, love him or hate him. There's so much crazy stuff comes out all the time that it's impossible to, you have to keep turning it over because the latest story the story that you thought was a hot issue like 1 month ago has been buried by 15 other stories by the time you tell the joke. So
he's the gift that keeps giving, and every comic in the world is going to go, fuck that guy, fuck him. It's like, I'm going to tell you something. When that election comes, you better pray he gets elected because it is so good for our livelihood. It's so good for those late-night talk shows.
Well, I really look forward to seeing the new hour. It should be a lot of fun. February 20th to 22nd, Steve. Real quick, I'm sold. I'm going to be at your shows. You're a Hollywood guy now, though, so if someone is, if someone listening is not convinced, elevator pitch. Why should they come see Steve Byrne February 20th to 22nd at the DC Improv?
Well, here's why I think you should come to see me. Because I care. Because I give a shit. Because there's so many comics out there that I believe are fucking phoning it in. They go up with their cool diesel jeans or some cool fucking jacket. And they I don't know, for some reason there's this blasé attitude sometimes from comics that I see. That people always ask me, why do you wear a suit? It's like, well, I want to dress up for them. They got a sitter. They went out. It's a night out. Of course I want to give them the best show I can. So I think that's the one thing consistently I'll say is that I give a shit, and I always try to come back with some new material. So that's kind of my two-cent sales pitch.
Steve Byrne, he gives a shit. I'm going to go change all the posters so that they say that.
That's right, yeah.
Right now.
Yep.
Awesome. Well, Steve, it's great chatting with you as always. I really look forward to seeing your stand-up and the movies. The opening act. I've already watched Amazing Jonathan. Always amazing. Really great chatting with you, Steve. We'll see you in about a month.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me as always, and looking forward to it.
Ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. Steve Byrne. Steve is here February 20th through the 22nd. That's a Thursday through a Saturday. And remember, we have plans to screen Always Amazing on February 22nd in the afternoon with a Q&A session with Steve right after. All the info you need and links to tickets are over at dcimprov.com. Now I'm going to play director and say that's a wrap on this episode of The Other Side. Not going to lie, that felt good. Powerful. Yeah. Thank you to Steve Byrne for calling in to chat with us this week. You can find him on social media at Steve Byrne Live. That's S-T-E-V-E-B-Y-R-N-E-L-I-V-E. Steve Byrne Live. Our thanks to you for taking the time to listen. And hey, we would love to see you at the club for Steve's shows this February. But whatever you end up doing, we hope you fit a few laughs in there. We'll see you on the other side.